Hi there. You're listening to More Than a Wheel On. This is episode 40. Can you believe it? I can't. That's crazy. My name is Sean Ian Whelan, your host, and today in the studio I have with me
Peter Drew.
Hi there, everybody. Welcome to More Than a Whelan, a podcast about creative writing written by me, but most importantly, inspired by you. Hi there. Welcome back to More Than a Wheel, and we are coming at you from sunny downtown Collingwood at Castaway Studios in the greatest suburb of the world. And today, I am thrilled to be joined by Peter Drew, and I'm going to tell you a little bit more about him in a moment. But firstly, I am going to start off the podcast today with a poem, and I'll explain its relevance once I have read it. It is called Dude, I'm a Unicorn. Hello, I'm a unicorn smoking a cigarette, and I'm dead now. Or at least I could be. By the time you get here. If it's not the cigarettes that will kill me, it'll be some overzealous cancer worker, an anti-magic malicious tagger, or maybe even Banksy himself seeking revenge for his fallen rat. Although now, those rats are everywhere. You can't walk a meter without one parachuting on your head these days. But I should clarify that here the term these days doesn't mean much. Tomorrow is a different story, or a million different stories, and a million different shades of now. And you should know, you're the one writing them. I guess what I'm saying is that if I'm not here, don't let it bother you. I'm not worried. Dude, I'm a unicorn. I don't know how to worry. And if I'm not here, I'm probably just a coat or two behind. I can still see you from back here, no matter how much I'm covered up. We can always see you from the other side of the mirror. That's why you put us up here. And remember, I'm a unicorn, smoking a cigarette. How hard can that be to imagine? Imagine? That's all we do around here. My tomorrow is your today. How's the view over there? And how's the view here? Have I put on weight? It's okay. You can be honest. I used to run a lot more. When I was in a children's book, whoa, did I get up to some fucking crazy stuff back then. I even used to fly sometimes. Can you imagine that? It didn't really agree with me though, to be honest. That flying stuff. It's so weird, running in midair. Have you ever tried it? And the clouds used to get up my nose and I developed an allergy to them. And sometimes I'd have a sneezing fit until I fell out of the sky. Then one day, somebody decided I was needed here. They cut off my head, threw me against the wall, and drained my rainbow. It's okay. It's not as bad as it sounds. There are so few rainbows in the CBD, so I can see their reasoning behind it. And it's not so bad here. You've probably noticed Ganesh to my left. We've become such good friends. He gives the world's best neck rub. And sometimes in the wee small hours of the morning, he jumps on my back, and we ride down to the river's edge, and he tells me what it used to be like being a god. He cries sometimes recalling those heady days of devotion. And then his diamond speckled tears mixes with my draining rainbow and it all flows out into the Yarra. Oh man, you should see that river when it's full of that. If you come here for answers, I'm probably not much use. I'm not the oracle I used to be. But I know who is. Come closer and I'll tell you a secret. Closer, closer. Now listen. Take a short walk down towards Flinders Street. Find the fish in the form of fingerprints. You got that? Fish as fingerprints. Okay. Once you do, press your thumb against one and just believe. Just like it's written. I know it sounds a bit fruity, but dude, again, I'm a unicorn. Fruity is what we do. It's just my default position. deal with it. Believing's not hard, is it? I'll tell you this for nothing. Once you do, whatever you need to know will land softly on your head, not quite like a rat wearing a parachute. That would be gross. More like a meerkat in a hot air balloon. And remember, after all this, I still love you, even while my rainbow leaks through the city streets. Right. Okay. Thank you. That was a poem I wrote quite some time ago called Dude, I'm a Unicorn. And its relevance is that today I'm so thrilled to have in the studio Peter Drew, who is, I would arguably say, responsible for the most iconic street art in the country. Thank you, Peter.
Thanks for having me. I was really spun out by your poem. It was terrific. That was really great.
Thank you. I'll give you a little background on that. It was written I was commissioned to do it for something called Melbourne Poetry Map. And what they did is they commissioned a whole bunch of poets to pick locations in the city to write a poem on. And then they all recorded. So you could go around with this app and go to locations and listen to the poem. And that was written about Hosier Lane and about this unicorn smoking a cigarette. I'm not even sure if the unicorn is still there. I'll throw up a photo of it in our
Was it an actual physical unicorn's head, or was it a painting of a unicorn?
A painting of a unicorn's head, yeah. It's sort of right up the end of Hosier Lane.
That rings a bell now, yeah.
It might still be there, and there were fish's fingerprints, and so I wanted to write a poem about the transitional nature of street art and how it's maybe there for a little time and then gone. And it seemed appropriate having you in the studio today.
Yeah, thanks. And I love the allusions to the spirituality in there as well, and just things being temporary and it being hard to, you know, the difficulty of being the responsibility, I guess, of being a unicorn, of being a god. That's all very interesting stuff. I really liked it. Yeah.
Thank you. I appreciate that. Well, I really liked your book, which has just come out. It's called Poster Boy, a memoir of art and politics. And it's by Blacking Books. You'll find it everywhere in your favorite little bookshops or your favorite online bookshops. And traces your pretty incredible journey becoming vaguely interested in street art to, as I say, I would argue, creating the most iconic street art this country has ever seen.
Well, it's a long, long trip, and I was really caught up in it myself for a long time, just caught up in the momentum of all the enthusiasm that was sort of shouted in my direction over a few years. And so I think that must happen to lots of artists, that they hit on something that people respond to. And then in my case, I just ran with it in some ways without really taking time to analyze what I was doing and my reasons for doing it. Because after a few years, I had to go, it's a bit weird to travel around sticking up posters. How has that become my whole life? And so the book was really a great chance to make sense of it all.
I should explain for our listeners what these posters are. I mean, I think maybe it sort of really gained traction perhaps with the Real Australians Say Welcome.
Mm-hmm.
Would you say that was the sort of start of it, really sort of?
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah. And then morphed into just ones that plain say Aussie with different racial identities on them. With messages that are very, very simple, but very, very clear at the same time. And I guess that they're the best messages, aren't they?
Yeah, well, I think they're the ones that people jump on the most, is the messages that offer some sort of simple solution to something that seems complex and anxiety-inducing, perhaps. It's very tempting to find a slogan that makes sense of everything. You know, I think that's one of the major themes of the book is realizing that those certain easy solutions, they only work for a certain amount of time. And you know, you can't sort of squeeze the entire universe into a poster. It just doesn't work.
Yeah. When you're from Adelaide.
Yeah, that's right.
And did you start putting them up in Adelaide? Or?
Yeah, but I've been doing it for a long time before I started doing big national projects. I had the biggest project I did early on in Adelaide was with mugshots, like photographs of old criminals from the 1920s. And that was the first project that I stuck up all over Adelaide to try
Amazing.
to get lots of people to see. Because there's a difference between, I mean, there's so many different types of street art. Some stuff is very small and very subcultural, but there's an effect you can have when you put up one image or one type of image all over the city, and then everyone's seen it and everyone's talking about it. It's a very different type of, less sort of personal subcultural effect.
Mm. And you first started getting out on the streets when you were in London, was that correct?
Well, I mean, that was when I started doing political street art.
Right, yes.
Earlier on, my stuff was more, I guess, esoteric and less sort of overtly political. The very first political poster I ever made was a poster. It was in the style of a 19th century street poster. And it said, and this came out during the 2013 Australian federal elections. And both major parties were promising to stop the boats. And that phrase, stop the boats, seemed pretty absurd to me, coming from a nation of immigrants. So I just sort of had an impulse to make this poster design that said, what did it say? It said, Australia says, stop the boats, to avoid Aboriginal genocide, stop Great Britain's illegal migration to Australia. And had a picture of a boat from the First Fleet. And so I went down to London because I was living in Glasgow at the time, and I stuck up a bunch of posters all over this place. And I just sort of, yeah, and from then on, I've been on that sort of train of doing stuff about Australian identity.
There's a great photo of that poster in the book, and you tell a story of actually being accosted by someone while you were putting up one of those, a black guy.
Yeah.
Yeah.
What was interesting about it is that he liked the phrase. He got my posters, but he was saying how, no, that's, he said to me, no, that's good. They should stop the boats, you know, keep the country pure. And I just thought, but mate, you're clearly a recent immigrant, or at least maybe your parents were. And I just think it was at that moment I thought, this stuff is more complicated than what I thought.
Very complicated. Yeah. And depressingly, since you started doing this, it's only even more relevant now, with government after government and layers of cruelty and fearmongering.
Yeah, well, it's a reliable political button, fear, isn't it? It's always going to be there, and it's sort of, it takes something, people need to reach deep into themselves and to find something bigger than themselves in order to overcome fear. And art can help us do that. Political leadership can help us do that. But there's always going to be that button. There's always going to be people that can stand up and say, whoa, look at the scary boogeyman coming here on boats. Elect me and I'll keep you safe. I don't think that's ever going to go away.
Yeah, but I was thinking about this in the cab on the way here. But where does racism come from in the first place? I don't think it comes from politicians. And people aren't born with it. So, I mean, I do have a theory, actually.
Well, yeah, what's your theory?
I think there's one person who is more evil than anybody else, any politician on this earth, and his name is Rupert Murdoch, because that's where it comes from. It's the trash they read in newspapers.
But Rupert must have got it from somewhere then.
Yeah, but yeah, where did Rupert get it from?
Unless you're trying to say something even bigger, that he is just the devil.
If there is a devil on earth, then he's a high candidate for it in my book. Yeah. Yeah, I think he's responsible for, because he makes or breaks elections in many ways. He's more powerful than most politicians. What he can do is more powerful.
I think we should be careful not to flatter him by overstating his power. Though. I mean, as repellent as the worst people are, I think, and this is something that I go back to in the book, is that I think that's in all of us. That capacity for bigotry is in all of us, and it's dangerous when we forget that. If we treat it like it's a like it's something that we can eradicate, and that desire for,
it's a really good point.
Yeah, because when you think of yourself as morally pure, you're dangerous. Like, you're dangerous to do the worst that people can do, and that's really where bigotry comes from. People who are bigoted, they are certain of themselves, and they're certain of the goodness in their ethnicity or their political ideas. It's that certainty that is dangerous, I think.
Oh, absolutely. And don't get me wrong, I'm certainly not suggesting that I'm pure at heart. I think you make a really good point. I think racism is possible in everybody, and bigotism, whatever you want to call it. I've had racist thoughts, absolutely. I mean, most people have. But I think the difference, I guess, is just recognizing that that's a bad thought.
Well, absolutely. And in the case of politicians or powerful people, it's recognizing it and then exploiting it and saying, look, there's this racism out there. And if we push this button by using this dog whistle, or then we can get people elected and hold on to power. And that's something that's quite different to, you know, the bigoted thought that you might have. Once you start exploiting it for your own sort of acquisition of power, that's something on a completely different level.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. It has much more serious ramifications as it does on a daily basis, not just in this country, but in many, many countries all over the world. In fact, it seems to be leading political thought. My only hope is that if we can have these extremes to the right in as far as political movements, and it's equally possible we can have these extremes back to the left. And the only thing that's guaranteed is change and change again, you know. Mm. Yeah. So I am a little bit optimistic.
I try to stay optimistic, and I think that's what I try to do in my posters as well, is give people something to feel hopeful about, because the opposite is too easy in a way. That's what I didn't like about the poster, Australia Says Stop the Boats, because there was something cynical about it. And I mean, I still think it's a good poster, but it didn't really offer any solution. And I think that it's too easy just to go, well, isn't everything shit? You know, like that's...
Yeah, it is. It's very easy.
And you can sort of, you start to spiral. And and for my own sort of sanity, I don't like to sort of indulge in that. But I don't really fault others for doing it either. So,
yeah. There was an interesting part in the book, and if you could explain to me about going about the origins of the meme.
Oh, yeah. No, I thought that was because I studied that when I was at uni, and I think that it's interesting because we all know about memes these days, but a good 10 years or so, like, we'd never heard of them because it's a thing of internet culture. And the word meme comes from a Richard Dawkins book that came out back in the 70s, I think, called The Selfish Gene.
This is fascinating to me because I knew nothing about this. But yeah, go on.
Yeah, so Dawkins had this idea that culture is culture sort of follows the same patterns as biological gene replication. So he, in The Selfish Gene, he posits the idea that all biological life is essentially genes, these little patterns of genetic code, wanting to copy themselves and essentially building biological bodies as machines around themselves in order to survive and copy themselves. And he sort of thought, well, what if culture operates under the same pattern? What if every bit of culture is essentially like a little idea that is trying to copy itself? So it wants to spread. It wants to, whether it's a religion or a, you know, a way of cooking eggs or anything, any piece of culture is this little idea that wants to copy itself. And so internet memes are a good example of that, because it's this idea that you see copied again and again and again in different iterations. Everyone that sort of sees a meme, they go, I see what the creator did there. I can continue it by changing it a little bit, and you see the pattern. And so I made a meme back in, I think it was 2007. It was a stencil that I stuck up on the street about bikes, and it said, what did it say? It was a picture of a bike, and it says, this one runs on fat and saves you money. And then there was a picture of a car, and it said, this one runs on money and makes you fat. And so it's this thing about bikes being good, I guess. But because it was such a simple, repeatable idea, it started popping up on the internet. People were putting on t-shirts and just without any regard for who actually made it, because who cares who started a meme, really? It's about taking ownership of the idea and making it your own. And so it just sort of, if you search this one runs on fat or something like that, you'll find all these mugs and t-shirts that are all
over. I bet it's all over Etsy.
Yeah, exactly. And I just...
How did that feel? Like, no, great. Like, yeah, you'd have no problem with like people profiteering out of your memes?
No, I mean, it's... You can't, and it's and it's. I mean, who wrote the first knock knock joke? You know, it becomes this.
That's good.
It's just this tool that we, you know, that, and you. It's just a. It's like a life form. You just want to see it survive.
Yeah.
It to sort of attach your ego to it is a bit silly in some ways. So, I took that. I remember creating that meme, and I thought, if I can have the same effect with Real Australians Say Welcome, that's a simple idea that I'm sure people can copy and add something to that will help it spread. And that's, it made the original idea more powerful than if I just did a really big painting that or something. Like, if the more I was able to let the idea go, the more power it'd have out in the world.
Yeah, amazing. I think that's the best, one most wonderful attitude to have to that. Now, I'd like to talk to you too about the process of actually writing a book, which I assume would have been outside the comfort zone when that came up. And how did that come up?
I was asked to be on a panel about Australian national identity, and I found that I had a lot to say. At least I had a lot, you know, that was bubbling away in my head in the weeks prior to being on the panel. And then I showed up. There were three other panelists, and everyone got to speak for like a total of 10 minutes and said a few things that came to mind at that point. And then I got, you know, off the panel and thought, oh, I didn't get to say anything. and then straight afterwards, I had a chat to a really good friend of mine about this family secret that I'd sort of been carrying around for years at that point. And it felt really good to just talk about it. And suddenly on the drive home, it just clicked into place in my mind. I thought, oh, there's a connection here. There's Australia has these difficult secrets that we don't like to talk about. And that's somewhat like my family. And perhaps that's like all families. All families have some sort of a unresolved conflict or secret. Maybe one is a good analogy for the other. I think this is a book. I realized it wasn't something I could ever convey in a poster or on a panel discussion. So I went home and started looking into the process of writing a book.
Amazing. And then did you sort of make a pitch to a publisher, or how did that work?
Yeah, that's exactly what I did. That's actually the next thing I did. I spoke to a friend of mine, Anna Goldsworthy, who publishes with Black Ink, and said, can you put me in touch with anybody? And she gave me my editor's name and his email address. And so I sent him an email sort of saying, I I'm writing a book, and I'm at the stage that I would like to find a publisher, but at this point, I had not written anything. And he said, oh, yeah, that's sounds interesting. Why don't you send me a sample? And so, I jumped on the computer and wrote an introduction and a first chapter and sent that to him. And he was interested enough that he wanted to see more. And I think I had to do it that way just to give myself the confidence, because if he had said, if he had not replied or anything like that, I doubt I would have written this book, because I make posters and stick them up on the street. I needed someone to say, someone who really knew what they were talking about, this could be a book. And then that just gave me the confidence to pursue it.
I do want to make it very, very clear to our listeners too that it's not just a book about a guy going around in the dead of night putting up posters. It does cover your personal life as well. And it is actually a really, really beautiful mix of the personal and the political. And I think that's what I found really, really appealing about it, actually. And so like, you're, okay, I'm going to write a book. How did you find that process? Were there things, hurdles that you didn't expect?
It was very difficult. To be honest, the first half wasn't that hard, because I think I'd been thinking about it for a long time and it just really poured out. And then things sort of started to dry up.
And I know that feeling when it comes to writing.
Yeah, and I just didn't know. I thought that I was doing something wrong. And I just realized I had to sort of, I hadn't really thought up to that point. And now I had to sort of try to put in the work to resolve these things and tie the threads together. And that became pretty exciting, because when you sit down to write and you feel like there's nothing there, and then you concentrate and relax and sort of, and then it's, you let it come and it sort of starts to, the words appear in front of you. That's exciting. And I really enjoyed that part of it. And it was just sort of trying to get into that zone. And so the rest of the book did come eventually. And I sort of started listening to podcasts about writing and watching videos of other people talking about writing, and just sort of just to reassure myself, really. And it helped. It helped a lot.
How long did it take? How long did it take in total?
From go to woe, about 9 months, I'd say. Mm. So I don't really know whether that's fast or slow, but.
Yeah, me either. And the world of street artists is normally quite clandestine and secretive. Do you hang out with other street artists? Do you Banksy have these weekly meetings in basements and stuff, or you'd have to have a secret password to get in or something?
Well, I stick to myself a lot, to be honest. I used to have a shared space at a studio that was full of other artists, and a lot of them did stuff on the street as well. But I'm a bit of a loner, to be honest. I really like the independence of it. I think that's what attracted me to street art in the beginning, is that I could go out and do it without having to rely on other people. And I think that's just my personality. But I do love the street art subculture. You know, this sort of collection of people who don't fit in anywhere else, but they definitely fit in together, and they sort of they sort of back each other up.
Yeah. And is there a sort of is there an etiquette to being
Well, that comes from graffiti culture, that sort of code of, and the language, all the different words. There's a great documentary called Style Wars that came out
That's amazing.
All right.
Bananas. Yes. Highly recommend it. Isn't it fantastic? Oh,
it's amazing. It's the Bible of graffiti and hip hop. It's it's as if a documentary filmmaker found this subculture and deliberately set about explaining it in such a way that if young people saw it in Melbourne or anywhere else in the world, they'd go, I want to do that. I know all the words. I know how to, it taught the world how to make graffiti.
It's fascinating, and it's got a sort of a, you know, it's got good guys and bad guys in it, and it's got actual real drama in it as well. So it covers, like, what is it, late 70s, early 80s period in New York?
Yeah, yeah. No, exactly.
Yeah. And, yeah, well, tell me more about it.
Well, there's, I mean, there's a, what's his name? I think he's an, I can't remember his name. There's one character in it who's like, who's capping everyone else's stuff.
Yes, yeah, yeah. I can't remember his name. It's been quite some time since I've seen it, but talking about it now makes me really want to revisit it. Yeah.
Yeah. And it's, and you see the words that they're using, like the lingo for the, for sort of doing pieces or tags or throw ups. And those words were adopted by, you know, graffiti gangs all over the world. And yeah, I love it. I just sort of love that sort of, I mean, I don't really come from that world. I sort of, I came at it from, I just found out about it through Banksy and that whole sort of second wave of more stencil based stuff. But I just, it's like any culture really. It's sort of, it has the, it comes and goes in waves and, you know, things come up as a subculture, then they attract money and then they become more established and they sort of lose some authenticity in some way. I just think that sort of, that cycle is pretty fascinating.
The edition I had of Star Wars on, I had on DVD, I still do somewhere. And it had a sort of follow-up doco too, where they trace like what they're doing now and stuff. It was amazing. I can't recommend it enough. It's the definitely the best documentary I've ever seen on graffiti. Yeah.
Yeah. No,
fascinating. Have you had any run-ins with the law in your time?
Yeah, I have, but I mean, I sort of emphasize that it's kind of, it's always boring. Like, that's always the worst thing about getting arrested is just, oh, now you can expect to be bored for the next 6 hours because they're gonna take you back to the police station and slowly take your photo and your details. Like, it's so, you know, and especially it's the boredom especially hurts because everything leading up until then was so exciting because, like, you, oh, am I gonna get caught? Am I gonna get caught? And then you are, and it's like, oh, I've only been arrested a few times and it's always just been a fine. Although the first time I had a court appearance as well. And it's a funny, another sort of element of that is that every time I've been arrested it's with when I'm with somebody else. That's one of the reasons I really love doing it on my own. It's because, you know, you just look more suspicious if you're...
Right, yeah.
Yeah, if there's two of you.
Yeah.
Yeah. And the first time I was, it was in Adelaide. I was with a mate of mine who I was working in a kitchen and he was the chef and I was washing dishes and he was curious about, because I was telling him about my street art and we went out together and were sticking up paste ups on rooftops and someone must have seen us up on this rooftop. And so the police arrived and we were cornered. Like they had us pinned up there. So, but I climbed, I said, I told him to stay there. I climbed down and took the rap. Like they arrested me and took me to the police station. He just waited. And then once they had me arrested, all the police left and he was able to get away. Right. So from that day on, he was, you know, he's very, well, no, we were always good mates before then as well, but it's kind of, there's not many things in life when you get to sort of, you know, throw yourself on the grenade or whatever and like and save your mates. So that was fun.
Yeah, yeah. And what about having your work in outside of the street environment into galleries and that kind of thing? Is that something you're pursuing or interested in or done?
Yeah, yeah. No, yeah. I used to paint acrylics on canvas and have exhibitions. And I was sort of frustrated with that world in a way. That's one of the reasons why I gravitated towards street art, I think. But I'm getting back into it now because I can sort of do it on my own terms a little more. I never really wanted to rely on that world because you're sort of, and I talk about this in the book, you're sort of at the mercy of the disposable income of a very certain set of people. I mean, I can't afford... you know, they're luxury items. Contemporary art is a luxury. And I like art that is for people like me who can afford it. I like selling posters at a very affordable price. So I sort of always will do that. But there's something else that you can do with contemporary art as well. Like, you can say something that is more, I don't know, it's sort of the quality that art has when it's when it stays on the wall for a long time and isn't a poster. I think you can say something different that you can't say on a poster. And so
yeah.
I'm attracted to that as well. So I'm sort of getting back into it now.
You are now. Yeah. Oh, interesting. Interesting. I thought I might do another little poem as well. Also, thank you, because I believe you're our first artist on the show. The when More on the Wheel started, my original idea was to talk purely to writers, but I'm pushing the boundaries of that out now to just talk to any kind of creatives, really. Yeah. And you're been such a joy to talk to.
Oh, jeez.
All right, so I'm going to, again, in the spirit of having you on the show, I'm going to do another poem that is inspired by street art as well. And this is called Black-Hearted Tagger. On your 59th birthday, you bought 6 cans of black spray paint. At the hardware store, you felt nervous. You told them it was for a birdhouse. You're too old to be a b-boy. You're too old for graffiti. At the hardware store, you felt nervous. It's 20 minutes walk from your house to hers. You tagged telegraph poles of black love hearts all the way to her door. You told them it was for painting a birdhouse. You tagged telegraph poles of black love hearts. You signed them B-H-T, Black-Hearted Tagger. You're too old for graffiti. If the jacks caught you, you'd never outrun them. How'd you explain yourself? Black love hearts, one every block on the path to her door. You're too old for graffiti. 59-year-olds don't break dance. You'll do yourself an injury. You're too old for love. At the hardware store, you felt nervous. You told them you were spray painting your birdhouse. How could you explain it? Afterwards at home, you sit down and you stare at the speckled black paint on your hands. You listen to De La Soul. You know I love you better. Your back hurts from tagging. You're too old for graffiti. You're too old for crushes. She'll probably never notice them anyway. She doesn't even know you care. Black-hearted tagger. At the hardware store, buying spray cans, you felt nervous.
That's terrific.
Thank you. Do you ever feel nervous when you're buying like 2-ton tubs of glue?
Yeah, it's funny. You sort of, well, no, I mean, all my stuff is a pretty non-suspect. But,
right, yeah.
But in the beginning, like the first paint I ever bought for painting stencils was from a hardware store. But
yeah, right, yeah.
But yeah, I don't know. I've never looked suspect. Like, I didn't sort of, you know, if you show up wearing a hoodie covered with paint, you sort of, I can imagine you get people looking at you sideways. But I've never sort of attracted suspicion in that way. And when I do it these days, I wear high vis and do it in the middle of the day. And if anyone comes up to me and tells me to get lost, then I just say, yeah, no worries. You know?
Now Melbourne has become quite famous as a destination for street art. I'm not sure what the culture is like in Adelaide.
Well, it's not the same for sure. I mean, it's here. It's incredible. I mean, it's much better than in Sydney or any other Australian city.
Mm.
But it's still good in Adelaide. Mm. But there aren't many places in the world that are like it is here.
Yeah, there's this weird juxtaposition to it, actually, in that it generates real tourist dollars now. You know, Hosier Lane is an actual tourist destination, and yet, you know, you can still get fined for having black cans of spray paint in your bag and stuff, and there's still some pretty draconian laws against it at the same time.
That's it. Yeah, it's this, I love that that paradox, you know, like, because it's an attraction, but it's also vandalism, and I think that conflict between, I sort of describe it as being where our freedom of expression and the value of private property sort of conflicts. You know, we're always going to value private property. We're always going to value freedom of expression. But graffiti is where they, those two values sort of clash. And that's such a interesting thing. It's sort of inexhaustible in some ways, because no matter how much the council or corporations or whoever go, oh, we love this thing called street art and graffiti. It's so vibrant. We're going to put it on the side of our business. They're always going to go, oh, but can you, they're always going to try and control it and remove the criminal element.
Right.
And you can't, like, you, that's where the energy of it comes from, is from the freedom of, hey kid, with a spray can, you can get respect from this subculture.
Yeah. And at its core, it is anti-establishment. Yeah.
No, absolutely.
Yeah. Yeah. I do like how you mentioned in the book that you do have some laws of etiquette when it comes to locations, you know, ugly walls on, you know, in under railway bridges and stuff, always open. Government buildings up. You don't do private residences.
No, unless it's like a big apartment building or something like that.
Right. You try and stick away from small businesses. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, well, I mean, it's just, I don't hate the world, you know what I mean? Like, there's an element to that, to it. Like, when you're young, especially a young man, like, there's this element of just fuck the world, like, and things like graffiti, any sort of subculture is going to attract that element, and that's good. Like, it's good that these subcultures exist to attract people who are, I've just fallen out of love with the world. And I think I used to have a bit of that, for sure, to be honest. And the book in a lot of ways is about overcoming that, finding various ways to overcome it.
Yeah, it is, very much so. Very much recommend people getting out and reading that thing. What do you see about how do you see the future of street art?
Well, it's interesting, isn't it? Because we were talking before about the money that comes into it and the legitimacy, and that sort of tries to kill off the criminal element. And I just think that it can't. Like, it can't. They can never embrace it fully. And it's galleries have tried. That's the interesting thing about the art world, is the art world is, you know, they're all about creativity, but really, you know, galleries that have large capital investments, they need to protect that. And so if they try to have, and this has happened many times, that they'll have a street art themed exhibition, they'll bring in all the street artists, there's a list, there's the people who are selected, and then there's the people who are excluded. And there was a great case of the Mocha, the gallery in Los Angeles, commissioned a artist to paint an enormous mural, and it offended somebody, and so they sort of kowtowed to the people who were offended, and they painted over it. And so there are other examples as well of just the institution has to protect itself, and they can never fully embrace something that is purely about expression when it comes to street art, because it's that criminal element that is upsetting, and they have to sort of try to separate that. But I feel happy being attached to an art form that can never be fully killed off in that way, because there's always going to be, there's plenty of walls out there, you know, and there's always going to be people sort of saying, oh, we don't want you to paint this. So, and there's always going to be some kid who goes, well, I'm going to paint it. So, yeah.
Yeah, and we're talking about public spaces, and what's more ugly, you know, a tag or an ad for fucking Coke?
No, exactly. You know? the streets belong to us, you know. It's our place for discussion. It's a forum, and it's the most ancient forum we have for discussing the things that are concerned, that we want to talk about. And so, like, for that space to only be used by advertisers selling us stuff we don't need That's absurd. And there's a large movement of people in the sort of graffiti street art world who spent a lot of time pulling out the advertisements from bus shelters and just fucking them up essentially just subverting them. And so I like all of that stuff. I mean, I'm personally less, just temperamentally less destructive than that, but I like it better than the advertising. So yeah.
Oh, absolutely. 100%. And there's so many levels to what is, you know, labeled street art. I think it you know, goes right from someone scrawling a love poem in a public toilet, you know, to full-blown murals. They're all just maybe private expressions in public places. Yeah.
You know, absolutely. I mean, there can be as much love in a tag that's been perfected over decades as there is in a mural that was just commissioned by, I mean, these days you get murals being commissioned by like bottled water companies.
Yeah.
And it's just, it's not, it's, you can't, that's not the same, like that doesn't, just because it's, you know, had a lot of money pumped into it, it's, the artistic value is very difficult to quantify in that way. So I just love the, just the unassuming stuff is just as powerful to me. So
I have a friend who's a street artist, shout out, Mr. Mups, and he actually does a lot of work for councils, mostly up north Queensland way, doing, public toilets and lots of council work. And but he's also sometimes does restoring old murals. He did a mm-hmm. really interesting one recently, restoring an old one that had started to fade away. You know, so there's, I like that there's this respect to the art of sort of maintaining it too.
Absolutely,
know? Yeah.
And there's the Keith Haring mural just up the street. I just saw. I realized I think I'd seen it before, but I never really stopped to have a look. And that was restored about 5 years ago or so, wasn't it?
Yeah. It's funny because that's been there forever, and I used to see it without even knowing who he was, and then one day when I actually knew who Keith Haring was, it suddenly dawned on me, fuck, this is fucking remarkable that we have this. It is really remarkable.
Yeah, and that was back in 1984, I think. I mean, that's pretty terrific for him to have come through and for it to get painted here.
Yeah.
So, yeah, I wonder what the streets looked back then. There must have been a lot less graffiti and street art back in 1984.
Absolutely. Just to imagine Keith Haring being in Collingwood, of all places, painting a mural in the 80s is just such a mind-blowing vision. Yeah.
Yeah. It's funny as well. You sort of said how you didn't notice it. Like that, it just, things like that just become so much a part of the landscape. You just sort of stop seeing them after a while.
Yeah, that's true.
Yeah.
Yeah. Wow. Now, we're about to do Wheeling and Stealing, but actually, go heavy trigger finger there, Derek, my producer. Actually, before we do that, I thought of one of my favorite pieces of toilet graffiti ever. It was just written in a toilet. It said, I fucked your mum. And then below that, it was like, go home, dad, you're drunk.
Wow.
Wow. Okay, now on to something completely different. Wheeling Stealing. Yeah. So today I want to read just an excerpt from a little essay that a wonderful poet, spoken word performer and friend of mine, Nathan Curnow, has written for somebody, the Australian Voice Association. It is online. I will drop a link to it in the show notes. But I want to read this because it's actually, I think it's one of the most remarkable essays on the art of spoken word that I've ever read. So I'm just going to read just a little bit from the beginning of it. June 2018, we're about to perform in the German city of Heidelberg. It's a beautiful evening and we're trying to keep calm as the sun dips below the rooftops of the Baroque streetscape. It's the opening night of their annual literary festival. The Spiegel tent has been erected in one of the cobblestone squares of the old town district, and now sound check is over. The stage is set. The venue is filling up. I have to be cool. But it's easy to be undone by the significance of all this. The city of Heidelberg has flown us halfway around the world to be the headline act in the birthplace of romantic poetry. For me, it's a combination of 20 years as a poet and spoken word performer. I've worked countless rowdy bars, quiet libraries, country halls, and tin sheds using nothing but my voice. Spoken worders aren't singers, comedians, or musicians. We don't have tunes, punchlines, or a guitar to hang around our necks. We don't even have a piece of paper to read from. All we have is a bare stage, a microphone, and our memory, which we hope works, plus some experience in rhythm, rhyme, and intonation. We manage air for an audience, the air across our vocal cords, the air that we form into words. Now jump back 20 years to when I first got up at an open mic. Imagine a dark upstairs room with bodies jammed onto couches so run down that no undergrad would want them in their share house. It's a hot and stuffy Wednesday night on Brunswick Street in Melbourne. Windows jammed open for fresh air. Trams dinging their bells as they pass. You're in a room full of weirdos and wannabes, each one waiting for their name to be pulled from a baby doll's head. You're at Babbel, and suddenly you've been chosen to have your 3 minutes on stage. It was do or die back then, and most of us died. Some were a three-minute train wreck. Each night was an electric circus of danger and possibility. The room supercharged by failure, success, and expectation. It was there that I began exploring voice. I listened for hours, asking why some people were hit and some people completely missed. Mostly, it was a total drag of a night, except for one magical moment when someone got up and did something amazing. Something that gave us enough reason to return the following week and endure it all again. So there's much more to that, and I do take a little bit of exception that mostly it was a drag of a night. I actually ran that poetry night. Thanks, Nathan. I just really love a lot of what he has to say there. And it's not often you see the art of spoken word broken down like that. And he goes on to talk about the internal and the meaning and the audience. And I just think it's remarkable. So have a look out for that. And now we're on to the world of Whelan.
Wow.
Cracks me up every time.
I should write a fucking script for this.
Oh, it's got a new sound effect. Wow. Okay, that's great. Okay, what are we on? What's coming up in the world we're on? I've got quite a few things coming up, but what I would like to mention is specifically Cali Café Philosophique de l'Amour. So this is a series of events that's going to be every Tuesday in October at the ESPY, the refurbished ESPY, which I haven't been to yet since they've reopened it. So I'm looking forward to that. I'll be doing it on the October 15th and with Andy Jackson, Farah Bia. No, hang on, sorry. I've got the wrong list of names. Here we are. Andy Jackson, Manisha Anjali, previous guest on the show, as Andy Jackson is too, and Ebony Moncrief, who hasn't been on this show but will be. I'm going to get her on the show very soon. The format of the show is it's a theme. In this case, it's relationships with ourselves, and each of the writers does something to their theme. But what's unique about it is that in the second half, the writers go out into the audience and we gather into groups, and then it becomes a kind of in conversation kind of thing. And they're really great events. I'm going to go to every one of them. There's different lineups every Tuesday in October at the ESPY. And what's coming up in the world of Peter Drew? Peter? What's on the horizon for you?
Well, this Sunday, I'm not sure when this is.
Yeah, we're not sure either. What day is it? Thursday. Yeah, it might be out by then.
Well, this Sunday I'm going to be launching the book in Sydney and Newtown at Better Red Than Dead, which is a bookstore there.
And that's a great name for a bookshop.
Yeah, it's great. And after that, there's more book stuff, but I've got a bunch of posters which I'm waiting to release. I've just sort of been holding them back. So I'm looking forward to getting on with that. And and now that I've started writing, I've started writing again. I want to do another book. But that's just
you got the bug now.
I think so, because
fantastic.
Yeah. It's something I want to continue, but I'm right at that very beginning stage again. So it's just all uncertainty and just trying to sort of catch that thread.
For a first book, you've got a very strong voice in it, and yes, I'm very pleased to hear that there'll be more. Yeah.
Cheers. Thanks a lot.
Yeah. You've got promotional plans for the book overseas?
No. I mean, that's the sort of thing that the publisher will... I think that sort of happens in stages if we sort of get a strong interest. So I'll just sort of waiting to hear what their plans are. So it's... it's been interesting learning how the book world works, because I've really come into it knowing nothing. So it's, interesting.
Yeah, well, it's certainly not a sort of geocentric sort of topic. It would certainly have appeal overseas,
Yeah, for sure. Well, I mean, people would have to be interested, at least somewhat interested in Australia. But but the themes are universal when it comes to politics and the politics of identity and how art helps sort of negotiate those identities.
Yeah, absolutely. It's been such a pleasure to talk to you today. Thank you so much. I'm going to get you to autograph my book before you leave, so don't forget to do that. I'm going to drop some images of your work in our show notes too, and links to where people can buy the book. But I know for a fact it's in all the good bookshops in Melbourne at the moment. Many, many thanks to Castaway Studios, without whom I would not exist. Many thanks to Lux Country, our generous sponsor. And many thanks to Peter Drew for coming in, having a little chin wag with us.
Thanks for having me.
And many thanks to you, our listeners. I don't have a poem, listener-inspired poem for you today. It just didn't happen. Whatever. Sometimes that shit happens. but I will definitely have something for you next week. And, there was something I was going to mention. I forgot to mention. We had our live show at the Melbourne Writers Festival, and it was amazing. And I need to thank everyone that came out for it. It was incredible. I need to thank Hannah Blackburn. I need to thank Natalie Jeffries. And I need to thank Aurelia St. Clair and Justin Bernasconi, all our performers, because it was really something magical. And we have another live show coming up already. Amazing. We're going to do one at Merry Creek Tavern, where we've done all our previous live shows. They've been very, very good to us. Wonderful venue. Theme? Not quite decided yet. I think I've got it in my head, but I haven't quite locked it down. But all the details will be out on the socials very, very soon. But keep Wednesday, October 2nd, 3. Okay. Thank you. Whelan out.
That awesome podcast was recorded at Castaway Studios in Collingwood. Here, we provide affordable, accessible, professional podcasting production facilities to the full range of podcasters, all the way from basic studio hire right through to full season production packages. You can get us on castawaycollingwood@gmail.com or just look up Castaway Studios on all the social medias.